Good evening. Welcome to the annual Tompkins County Budget Forum. I'm Michael Lane. I'm the chair of the Budget and Personnel Committee for the county this year. The legislature is here. They've been meeting as what we call an expanded budget committee over the last 3 or 4 weeks, hearing from different departments about their requests and hearing from our county administrator as to his recommended budget. We will, after hearing your comments, and the reason we have this meeting is to hear your comments before we get finalize the budget. Until we finalize the budget, we want to know about what you think before we cast all our votes. After this meeting, we will have some more expanded budget committee meetings in which we will vote on various amendments over target requests that are before us and others that may be added. To start out tonight, I'd like to go around and have the legislators introduce themselves to the people who are here tonight. Before I do that, I want to thank Marsha Lynch, our public information officer, and the Public Information Advisory Board that helped to sponsor this forum so that we could hear from the public. So if we could go around. Martha, would you just say your name and what your district is?
Hi, Mike. Martha Robertson, District 13, the western half of the town of Dryden.
Rich John, District 4. I represent part of the city, College Town, East Hill, the Commons, a bit of Fall Creek, and some of Cornell.
I'm Amanda Champion. I represent District 12, which is town of Ithaca, west side of town.
Hi, Ann Corman, District 5, which is the town of Ulysses, including Trumansburg, the northern third of Enfield, and a small portion of the town of Ithaca up right before the hospital.
I'm Leslie McBean Claiborne. I represent District 1, a portion of downtown and West Hill in the city of Ithaca.
I'm Glenn Morey. I represent District 9, which is all of Groton, and small portions of Lansing and Dryden.
I'm Anna Kellis. I represent District 2, which is most of Fall Creek and also a part of Cornell.
Hi, I'm Henry Granison. I represent District 3, which is Belle Sherman, a little bit of South Hill, and Brian Park.
Mike Sigler, District 6, representing the town of Lansing, home of the chicken nugget.
I'm Dave McKenna. I represent District 8, which is all of Newfield and Enfield as far as Route 79 from the Enfield or from the Newfield side.
Dan Klein, Danby, Caroline, and a little slice of the town of Ithaca.
Shauna Black, District 11, the northeast area, Forest Home, a little bit of South Hill and Eastern Heights.
Deborah Dawson, District 10, which is the villages of Lansing and Cayuga Heights and includes Renwick Heights.
My district is in Dryden, number 14, which is the east half of Dryden, most of the east half of Dryden, including the two villages of Dryden and Freeville. We have two other very important people here about our budget, and they can introduce themselves.
Thank you. I'm Jason Molino. I'm the Tompkins County Administrator.
Kevin? Absolutely.
I'm Kevin McGuire. I'm the budget coordinator.
I'm sorry, Marsha, you're saying something to me.
Lisa, you've got to introduce
Lisa. I'm
Lisa.
Sorry. Lisa, you want to introduce yourself? One of our new deputies here. Lisa Holmes, Deputy County Administrator. Did I miss anybody else? Okay. We're going to start out tonight with by turning to our county administrator for a brief overview of his recommended budget. And then after that, we'll take questions and comments from everyone.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, members of the legislature and the public. Tonight, I'm going to go through a similar version, an identical version of the budget presentation I gave September 4th. There are some changes in there, and I'll let the public know some of those changes as they've come up. Nothing too much so far, but some general changes that have happened, and we'll go from there. If there's any questions, I can be happy to answer the questions at the legislature's request. With the recommended budget, we'll start with the end of the budget process, which is what I would call the bottom. The bottom line. We're going to talk a little bit about stable growth in revenues and how that has helped the budget process. That's primarily sales tax and tax base. It continues to support current and new priorities from performance measurement, the workplace climate survey, jail population reduction, housing. This is obviously not an exclusive list, but just a few that they continue and continue to build on. At the end of the day, the levy has proposed on September 4th. It was a levy increase, not a tax rate, but a tax levy increase of 1.3%. It is now the fifth consecutive year that the rate has been proposed as a decrease. In addition to the tax rate or tax levy, there is a $3 increase in the solid waste fee, and I will definitely talk a little bit more about why that is. At the end of the day, with the tax levy increase and increase in assessed values, we'll talk about that for a typical home, as well as the increase in the solid waste fee, the average impact or the impact on the average homeowner is about $15 a year. Most government budgets have economic and fiscal indicators, and those indicators or the fiscal and economic indicators are affected by the economy. There's programmatic impacts and there's economic or economy impacts. A little bit of the things that impact our budget, unemployment. Generally, lower unemployment is good. That usually relates to higher wages, higher earnings, therefore higher consumer confidence, and sales tax usually benefits from that, as is home ownership. As you can see, Tompkins County is generally lower than the southern tier and generally lower than the state of New York, and that holds true as of July of 2018. Inflation still seems to be our friend for a period of time. It is up a little bit, 2.9%, but nothing that has impacted consumer products or commodities so far. Consumer confidence is up. March of this year was an all-time 14-year all-time high in consumer confidence. Again, consumer confidence usually relates into increased sales tax or increased consumer buying power. We'll talk a little bit about the trends of sales tax over the course of the past several years. The market, meaning the financial market, seems to still be strong despite a slight blip after the new year. But generally speaking, again, generally, when the financial market is strong, earnings are up, growth is up, and investment is up, which usually bodes well for our budgets. That's the basic economic factors. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the programmatic indicators of need, which have to do with some of the different services that we provide. This is also impacted by the economy, and there's usually a correlation between it. SNAP, one of the major general services that we provide, has to do with this, food stamps. As you can see, has been a downward trend over the past two and 3 years. It's been down in terms of caseloads, but still higher than January of 2008, which would be pre-recession. And this is for several reasons. Some of it is for programmatic changes, and some of it is demonstrating that some folks have been have been left behind and have not been able to recover with the economy or pull themselves out of those positions due to the recovery in the economy. TANF, which is a temporary assistance for needy families, again, this is a federal benefit. As you can see, the caseload is definitely trending downward. Several reasons for that. It's down 28% for 2008. There is no local cost to this benefit. We administer it, but there's no local cost, and hence there's no local savings. But there's also a five-year lifetime eligibility. So after that eligibility expires, if there's still a need, folks then shift to the state portion of this benefit, which is safety net. And safety net remains above what it was in January of 2008, so there's some growth there. It's down a little bit over the past year, but not much when you look over the past 10 years. The difference with safety net than with TANF, and which is relevant to us, is that there is a local share in this. 71% is local funding, meaning we pay for that. 29% is paid for by state. This is a state mandate. You don't have any discretion over that percentage of that breakup. This chart combines the last two and kind of shows the downward trend of TANF, which was family assistance on this chart in red, shows that decline, which is offset by an increase in safety net. Interestingly, the portion or the percentage, let me back up, the total claims over the 10-year period hasn't really changed a whole lot of the total cases, I should say. What has changed is our, or the safety net portion of those total cases, which means we have a greater local share than we did 10 years ago. And that's obvious in this trend. There's a clear shift from TANF to safety net, TANF having that 5-year eligibility limit. And again, no local cost with TANF, but we do pick up the cost when folks shift over to safety net. So those are some of the indicators of need. Some of the budget drivers, obviously revenues is a big part of this. We're going to talk a little bit about sales tax because that has changed with no consistency over the past 5 to 6 years. And we'll talk about what that means to us and how we try to project future years when we have no stability and consistency of prior history. Tax base growth has been consistent for the county, which is good. We'll talk a little bit also about casino revenue, which is a new revenue that came about last year due to two casinos that we benefit from. We can talk a little bit about mandates, labor costs, which is a big driver because most of our costs are labor driven because we provide services, and capital investments, that'll be the capital plan. Sales tax. The average annual sales tax growth over the past decade has been about 2% a year. That's actual receipts, what we actually receive 1 year over the prior year. If you go back about 15 years, the average goes up a little bit to about 2.5%. There's several exceptions. One is in 2009, which is probably what most people remember the most. It would have been about the Great Recession time. You saw a 6% drop in actual receipts. You saw smaller drops in receipts from year over prior year in 15 and 16. There's really no clear explanation as to why that was the case. Consumer confidence was good. Unemployment was low. So there's some speculation as to why that was the case, but that you saw pretty much through the state of New York that since either leveling or small dips in sales tax. In 2017, you saw good growth. That was last year, about a 6.5% growth over 16. And this year, as Rick reported last night, you continue to see good trends, and for discussion purposes, we'll assume about a 6% growth over 17, which bodes well for us. It's in a good position to be in versus a decrease. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time about sales tax because it is your second largest revenue. A major change in it can impact your budget in both positive and negative ways. If we assume that the year finishes at a 6% growth over 2017, that is where your actual receipts will be over your budget. So you will be in a good position. You will have received more revenue than you anticipated. Generally, we want to see it that way. We always want to see, in this case, the orange line over the blue line. In this case, it's a decent amount. So what we want to look at is, all right, how do we project forward? When we want to put growth in the budget because we want it to be as close as the actual as possible, how much do we consider for growth? Generally, we would look at trends. As you can see from this, there isn't a consistent trend. You had growth in last year, but then it dipped. It was flat. It was flat or it dipped in the prior years. You had some growth before that. So there isn't a consistent trend to say, on average or over the past several years, we can expect this. So the challenge is if you budget too much growth and you have a change in the economy and it's erratic, you may find yourselves having to retract in 2020. We want to avoid that. Okay, so in this case, this is one example, and I'm going to show possibly a slowdown in the economy in the next slide. But let's assume for 1 second our recommended budget has about a 5.4% growth over the current year's budget. So 2019 budget is about 5.4% over 2018 budget. And let's assume also that there's a 2% growth, because that's your 10-year average from 2019 over 2022. If we were to gradually bring those two lines closer together, which is what we want to see, you're still going to benefit from some decent growth in subsequent years, in 2021 and 22 over the predecessor year. So that allows what I would call a slow growth into more practical and realistic terms with respect to getting as close as you can to the actual numbers. That's a good situation right there. You're not moving too fast, you're not moving too slow, but you're growing, you're going into it. And it also provides available capacity in the budget to grow and expand a little bit if you want to, or decrease the tax burden. In this case, let's assume the economy doesn't grow 2% a year. Let's assume for 2019 the recommended budget, again, has a 5.4% growth. But let's assume once the new year hits, we hit a recession or we hit a slowdown. Let's assume there is no growth in 2019. Let's assume there's a decrease in sales tax in 20, flat in 21, and then again a small growth again. That would be representative of possibly a recovery in the economy. If we were to do that, you still are in a position to not have to budget a negative or less money in future years for sales tax than the prior year, which is where you want to be. You'll have some modest growth in your budget, but not a lot, and it's better than having to go backwards as a negative. So this proposed budget in terms of sales tax, because it's your second largest revenue, it recommends growth in sales tax. I'll add that it's probably the single largest growth over prior year in the past 15 years, but it does it with an eye on the unknown, so it doesn't take off too much. It doesn't grow too much. It doesn't overstep its boundaries so that if you do have that 2019 or 20 change in the economy, you're not going to retract. You're not going to have to cut services or consider that because you supported them with maybe an overambitious revenue projection. 2019 balances a new baseline with an 18-month erratic surge. Right now, sales tax is steady. It's been steady for the past four or five quarters. The way it has trended over the past, say, 10 to 12 quarters has not been that consistent. And it allows for a course correction should the economy reverse. So let's say, for example, things don't pan out, the winter comes and it slows down, you can still make a correction in future years and not impact services. That's the goal. Obviously, we can't predict everything with sales tax, but I think it puts you in a safe place. It allows for growth, but not too much. At the same point, now it's not being overly conservative. Tax base has been, again, it's the bedrock of your property tax. So as your tax base grows, it spreads the cost of government or cost of services over a greater portion of value. As you can see, you've had a 4.3% growth in tax base over last year. That is a good growth. 12.3% over the past 3 years, and a 22% growth over 10 years. That's a good position to be in. That shows there's a solid and steady real estate market that warrants investment and has consistently had investment, and I would imagine that's reflective in the amount of development you're seeing in your downtown area here in Ithaca and some of the development you're seeing across the county. It also, as I mentioned earlier, allows you to spread the cost of government over a larger tax base. Casino revenue. Casino revenue was first budgeted this year for the 2018 budget. It was based off of estimates given from the state. You receive revenue from two casinos, Tioga Downs and DeLago, and that's primarily just due to your geographic region and the way the legislation is established. Interesting, after your budget was adopted, a few months after that, in February of 2018, DeLago had a bond downgrade because it wasn't receiving 40% of the revenue it had projected. We didn't really know what that means, and we really don't know what that means now in terms of impact on your revenue. Generally speaking, casinos don't close. They usually refinance debt and stay open, but we have no way of guesstimating or projecting what that may have on the revenue that you estimate or you budget for. As of July, the first four payments of the year were about 15% higher than they were in 2007. So despite the downgrade, revenue continues to come in from that source. At this time, with really 9 months under your belt, there's really no reason to change the proposed budget or change what was budgeted in 2018 above 1.2 for 2019, so we left it flat. In about a year or two, you might have some more trending. You might see it level off. If it still consistently grows, you might think about increasing that or more closer to actual, but right now there's no reason to change it. We don't know what that impact's going to be from the bond downgrade. I'll also mention, too, the revenues and the way revenue is distributed is through state legislation. Over the past 10 years, particularly with the racinos, with the VLTs, that legislation has changed from year to year, which means the formulas of revenue that the host communities get has changed. So there is no consistency with that, just as another unknown with this. Labor costs, your white-collar contract was settled this year. It's in place for 2019. That's about 60% of your workforce. We have three contracts that are up, and one of the major pieces of this next year's work plan, we'll try to get contracts secured and ratified for the 2019 year moving forward. Labor costs, we have some additional labor costs to the budget, about 2.5 employees spread out over multiple departments. This is primarily for succession planning. A 1.5 FTE for Raise the Age. This marks the This marks the second day or the third day of Raise the Age implementing. We haven't shut down. Everybody's still doing what they're doing. I think we're very well positioned for Raise the Age and managing it, but there are some increased probation costs as they're the primary intake of youth when it comes to Raise the Age. And we'll be in a constant state of assessment probably over the course of the next 2 to 3 years to see how we manage that. At the time of the recommended budget, one FTE was attributed to the school resource officer. As a correction, one of the corrections to this budget is BOCES has since withdrawn that request. It is still part of the recommended budget. You will still have to vote on amending that out, but they have since withdrawn the request. And there's a half a FTE increase in Department of Emergency Response, which has to do with some reorganization of the department. Fringes, at the time of the proposed budget, the estimate we had was a 6% increase in premiums. As I mentioned the other night, the healthcare consortium adopted a 5% increase about a week prior to that. We since made a correction in the budget, and we received some benefit and some savings due to that decrease in premium. Still, in the grand scheme of things, while pension remains flat and there's only a 5% increase in premium, it's about a $400,000 increase. I may say that only an increase of $400,000. In the world of health insurance, having a premium increase of 5% is very uncommon and very good in terms of managing health care costs. So that, you know, particularly when state agencies like the state, one of the state plans is increasing at a minimum of 9% and upwards of 12 and 15. Yeah. And that's year after year. So we're doing pretty good with that, despite only being $400,000 increase. Salaries and fringes are up a total of about 3.4%, a little over $2 million, about $1.6 million of local dollars. As you know, some of the different departments have state and federal reimbursement, which is why there's a less of a local impact. Mandates, fourth consecutive year of some downward trends with mandate expenses. I will note the increase in Medicaid. We had this discussion earlier. You do have a flat Medicaid cost, but believe it or not, the reason this has increased this year is because of the day of the year that the Tuesdays and Wednesdays fall on has to do with when the state bills Medicaid and when the state receives payment for Medicaid. So on certain years, there may be a slight increase. On certain years, there may be a slight decrease. And because the state fiscal year is on an April to March fiscal year, and ours is January, there will be offsetting years on that. That's clear as mud, but there is a rationale to it, but we do have a flat Medicaid cost when you look at it in state fiscal year groups. Overall, Medicaid mandate costs are down just a little bit. We discussed, was it last night? The night before. The nights are blurring together. Monday night, we talked about the capital policy, which includes the continued policy of a 0.5% increase of the prior year's levy into the capital budget or capital fund. This primarily supports debt service and some new projects. Two new projects that have been proposed is $2.5 million for renovations to the old jail. I believe some folks went through a tour of the jail today to see some of the existing facility. And about a $200,000 storage building for facilities in soil and water, which is a shared facility. I shared this with the group on Monday, that if you continued your 0.5% contribution to the capital fund on an annual basis, which would be the blue line, the capital levy, it could support another $20 million worth of debt and above your existing obligations. And the reason I put that in there is to show the value of that capital policy that you have. And you have some pressing issues, a jail potentially or an improvements to thereof, sheriff patrol building and downtown campus improvements, all space needs and space improvements we've talked about. $20 million of the debt may be a tip of the iceberg with it, but you have capacity and availability. You also have fund balance that can contribute to those capital costs. What's not considered, but we all know is lingering out there, is TCAT has been talking about some facility improvements of some sort, whether it's new or improved. And TC3's capital plan is coming up for discussion and probably another capital series of capital improvements to TC3. And again, what we're proposing with 2019 is that we actually use cash for those new improvements versus debt service. Next year, we'll also propose reviewing and updating the capital plan for the legislature to consider. Sponsored agencies. This budget supports a 2% increase in baseline budgets for all sponsored agencies. It adds about $513,000 of funded one-time support for agencies, and it also keeps the TC3 contribution flat, which, as you know, is a joint venture with Cortland County, and both of the underwriters have to contribute equally to TC3's operations. Contingency has a baseline of a $900,000 contingency budget. This is consistent with prior years and has met our prior years' needs when it comes to unintended expenditures, and it also has a separate one-time contingency line for potential jail board outs. This is the second of three-year one-time OTR with the loss of the jail variance last year. Uncertainty about jail board outs and what they may turn into or cost. This was put as a temporary contingency line. Fortunately, as we are now, jail board outs have been very low. So we have not had to come anywhere near needing that contingency. But we'll keep it in there as you only have about 9 months of experience under your belt right now without the variance. The airport budget, as an enterprise fund, generally speaking, airport and recycling and materials management are enterprise funds, which means they don't use property tax money to support them. They're supported by the general fees that they generate. In this case, this would be the fifth year of waiving about $120,000 administrative fee. So what they are able to do is, generally speaking, there's back office work, whether it's payroll, accounts payable, procurement, that is supported by the organization that supports these enterprise funds. There is a charge back that can be charged to those enterprise funds for those services because they're generally general fund employees or funded employees. When the airport was having more financial challenges, the legislature at the time decided to withdraw that administrative fee charge for 3 years. To allow the airport fund to improve itself financially. It has done so. It is now operating in the black. I'm recommending a fifth year only because you are in the middle of a $25 million capital project and suggest we revisit this come into 2020 as to how you either want to slowly integrate it back in or not integrate it at all. And again, we have a $25 million project at the airport, working feverishly with the state and the feds to assist with some of the gap that we're looking for, and I believe the governor will be here tomorrow to do a little groundbreaking on the project, which is great.
Friday.
I'm sorry, Friday. You can go tomorrow, but it won't be there. We have ribbon cutting tomorrow at the airport. That's what we have tomorrow, ribbon cutting tomorrow. The budget recommends a $3 per unit increase in the solid waste fee. And this is primarily due, and I'll show this on the next slide, due to increases in expenses and decreases in revenue. And it really leaves us with a pre-budget planning activity in 2019 as a priority so we can avoid future increases in 2020. So this is a little bit of a busy chart, but I think it's important, and it kind of demonstrates some different trends. Recycling revenue has been in a downward trend since 2000, well, with the exception of 2017. So if you look at the orange line, you can see, if you go back to 2013, a downward trend and then a spike in 2017. The 2018 number there is a projection, an estimate of where we think recycling revenues will come in. And this is primarily, and this is something the whole state and the country is seeing, is the change in commodity prices for a variety of reasons, but recycling material is not as valuable and people aren't purchasing as much as they were in the past. This is international purchasing which affects this. So with that downward trend, it made sense to continue that as terms of trying to budget what we think is going to be the actual receipt of revenue. So as you can see, the blue line, we were a little off over the past few years when it came to budgeting revenue, and we are going to decrease it over the current year 18 to try to match where we think that revenue is going to come into 19. So you have a downward trend in revenue. Also, if you look in 2018, the bar lines, you can see a big spike over 17 with respect to expenses. And that has to do with the rebidding of a collection contract, the recycling collection, the folks that come around and collect the recycling, that was rebid in 18, and it had about a $500,000 jump in expenses, as you can see, from 17 to 18. So you had an increase of about a $500,000 from 17 to 18 in expenses, and you had about a $400,000 decrease in revenue. And as you can see, if you look at 2013, revenues just about met expenses. And then look at 2019, revenues don't equal the collection expenses or don't aren't anywhere near the top of that bar graph, which is why we're recommending a $3 increase in that solid waste fee. It will be something we will have to look at closely next year, and depending on whether revenues are projected to improve based on the commodity markets. I know Barb presented on Monday. She presented some hope that this might be the bottom out of that recycling market, and corrugated cardboard is starting to improve its cost, which is usually the first indicator that the market may improve. I doubt it will improve drastically in a 1 year's time frame. So we may be after looking at a stopgap over a year or two, or possibly another rate increase in a year or two. But that's something we want to start to get into in the beginning months of 2019. This is just to show you the history of the fee over the past few years. It's been relatively flat, and there hasn't been a need not to keep it that way. So in this case, we have a little bit of a need. And like I said, next year will be a big evaluation period so we can figure out what to do in 2020. OTRs, over-target requests. So over-target requests usually come in two forms and fashions. One is a target request, which increases the base budget, which is usually supported by the tax levy. And one-time requests, or multi-year one-time requests, are supported by fund balance or reserves in that matter. In this case, we had a total of just under $2.4 million of total requests, and recommending not too much, but a little bit less than what was proposed. Most of it is one time, a little over $300,000 is target. A little bit of the target increase I'll go over. Again, the DUER reorganization, this has to do with increasing a half a time person and some reclassifications of several other positions. Human resources has making permanent one of three-quarter time employee. It also has to do with increasing our talent acquisition fund, which is generally costs associated with advertising for, I would say, middle to higher level positions in the organization, ensuring we are doing all we can and continue to improve the process of reaching out to different areas of the community and different ways of advertising for positions to improve the diversity of our workforce pool and diversity of the candidates that apply to our positions. Probation has an increase, a request for an increase of electronic monitoring, again, highly successful, another alternative to incarceration, which the probation department has used very successfully. The library is asking for a total of about a little over $35,000 of an increase in their target. End use services, trying to work towards 10 years ago when the budget was cut, trying to support some youth programs in some of the rural communities. Vehicle replacement is more of a one-time request. I think it says eight. So I think we're doing five this year and eight next year. We're proposing for next year. We're looking to replace some of the fleet with electric vehicles. And that has to do with outfitting both, obviously, replacing the vehicle itself, but also putting the charging stations in place in those the facilities. So we have quite a few replacements of vehicles, and they're all EVs. Again, decent amount of highway equipment. Jeff, has a decent amount in the budget, the operating budget he does to replace equipment, but usually every year if we have some fund balance from the highway fund, also look to replace additional equipment as it ages. And then, again, a few vehicles for the facilities department. What I call organizational performance and stability, putting some money aside to assist with the climate survey implementation. Continuing an OTR with the performance measurement program. Engineering support. This is some general engineering support related to capital planning as well as some of the space analysis and downtown relocation options that we want to put a team together to start to look at. And then also $50,000 to relocate the Office of Human Rights into the Human Services Annex, which will give them better space and up-to-date space as well as ADA accessible space. Continuation of some housing initiatives, the COC Transitional Housing Plan. I think this is the third year of a three-year request. New is the Consultant Matching Fund for Affordable Housing. Essentially, this is a good, it's a neat idea that came out, I think, out of the Housing Committee about trying to put aside some funds to assist local municipalities on whether it's planning, grant writing, or some type of study money related to affordable housing in their communities. So it's us trying to assist them in pushing and trying to encourage housing, affordable housing development. And then $65,000 for some training and equipment over at the Amici House for TC Action. Again, jail ATIs continues. This is really, when there's been a lot of discussion about it, but you're really only about 9 months into the implementation of some of the major initiatives you took on. You're really in the infancy of it. And it continues a lot of things that were started with this year. The contingency I already discussed, the criminal justice coordinator position, which is also partnered with the performance measurement program in the county that's out of our office. College initiative upstate, again, this would be the third year of supporting it in 2019. And a new parole housing case manager for OAR. And that's, I believe, a one-time request. Workforce improvements. So in this case, and we discussed this on Monday, Stop DWI activities. The revenue from Stop DWI has gone down drastically over the past few years. This is a one-time request to support two portions of DA positions, of two DA positions in the DA's office while we do an evaluation of the program next year to understand how we move forward. $150,000 of succession planning. So this is generally overlap of positions of folks that we know are retiring or have given enough notice that they're retiring, usually folks with 25-plus years of service. There's institutional knowledge, and the departments have been really proactive in identifying that as early as they can and requesting overlap for new hires and to fill those vacancies. I really think that's well worth its weight in gold with respect to making that investment, having the overlap with employees, the knowledge transfer, the ins and outs. It's a really good investment, and it allows for the learning curve to be minimized for when new folks come into critical positions.
Jason, about how many more slides so folks can get an idea? I know they want to make their comments here.
About 10 slides, but I'll make it quick.
Yeah, we probably should get
to that. All right, I will. Business Energy Navigator, again, is a continuation. The school resource officer has been removed. Requests, we can go through the OTRs as we have in the past, and obviously many others. This just shows you a breakdown of what was requested versus what was recommended. For the most part, recommended a lot of what was requested. We had not as many requested as in prior years, but they were good, good requests. I won't go through the tax cap formula because I'm sure everybody understands it very clearly. I'll fly through that. The short of it is we all know the center of the universe is the town of Dryden, and they have changed the tax cap calculation for us. The crown jewel, I'm sorry, I got that wrong. The crown jewel of the Compton County is John Dryden. Well, the crown jewel has jacked up the tax cap this year. I won't get into the explanation of it, but essentially you have an abnormal year because they're taking sales tax credit versus taking the sales tax revenue themselves. And as a result, this year you have a bump in the tax cap. Next year it'll go back to quote-unquote normal levels. Again, 1.43% levy increase, which is under the financial goal of 2.2% that the legislature gave us guidance on in May under the tax cap, supports agencies, supports the continuation of the operations, supports capital investment, and it incorporates and captures sales tax growth with what I would call caution. Total budget increase is a little over $4 million. Total local budget is a little over $1.8 million, and the actual tax levy increase is about $700,000 as proposed. That has to do with the rate change. So this year, because of your growth and tax base, your actual tax rate goes down by 18 cents. When you put all that together and add the $3 waste fee, you come to a $15 impact on an average home. A median home in 2019, not average.
I think folks can understand. Thank you, Jason. I think folks can understand from that the amount of thought and process that went into Jason developing his recommended budget to the county. I'm sure if you want to hear any more details about any of that, that he or others here would be glad to talk to you about it. But at this point, it's your turn. And we have a list of some folks that would like to speak to us tonight. If you haven't signed up and would like to speak, please go ahead and do that. We normally limit things to 3 minutes. We don't have a timer tonight. We don't have a whole lot of folks signed up. So just please be cognizant of the other folks that want to speak. Let's start with Susan Holland, then Tarpel Subward. Now, can you go to the... I think we're going to use the microphones. Sorry, but that's... We already told folks up in the control room that's what we were going to do.
Thank you. Sorry about that. The last time I was here for a meeting, sat there.
Well, sorry to confuse you.
No problem. Good evening, and thank you for the opportunity. Actually, those slides were really impressive. I was just... It's a lot of information. I'm Susan Holland, and I'm the executive director for Historic Ithaca and one of the partner organizations in the Tompkins Center for History and Culture. And much work and funding, thank you to Tompkins County, has been invested in this important center and resource that follows the county's strategic tourism plan. It's all coming to fruition after a lot of hard work and investment. The History Center is the fiscal sponsor for the Tompkins Center and has been able to garner major grants from New York State, Assembly Member Barbara Lifton, and of course Tompkins County. In order to operationalize and continue on the path to the opening in spring of 2019, the History Center must have a full staff to execute the plans currently in place. The bookkeeper position, which is in the budget, or should be in the budget, is integral to the Tompkins Center for History and Culture, and that person would be in charge of all accounting functions, managing the capital campaign, which is large, and tracking all expenses, and managing the large amount of grant funding, and some of it would be on a reimbursement schedule. The Tompkins Center has an absolute need for this position and for Tompkins County funding of $20,000 for that position. Full disclosure, Historic Ithaca would also benefit for the Ithaca Heritage brand that we do under a tourism grant, but we also have to supplement the book. We would be also willing to supplement the bookkeeper's income with other sources of funding. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this evening and ask for your support in funding this important position at the History Center in Tompkins County. Thank you.
Thank you. Laurel Southern.
Good evening. I'm a follow-up to that. I'm the president of the History Center Board of Directors. Let me roll back to Saturday. I hope a lot of you were at the airport and got to see the Tommy plane. Martha, thank you for all the great comments. Some of us thought he was never going to land. You know, he kept going over, and we'd go, wow, one more time. But it was great. There was a great crowd there, and a crowd that was really interesting. It was a lot of Tompkins County citizens, a lot of people who came from other places who were airplane buffs. So it was a great day. Now we turn our energy to the move. And so Tommy will go into the building at the end of the month, and on October 21st, I will be inviting you all to help us move history forward as we have a human chain moving delicate stuff. So it's an exciting time, and I'm just here to support our request for money to make sure that we administer all these funds correctly. State grants are a lot of fun. We want to make sure that we thank donors. We've had a lot of great people, and so I hope you will support our request. And we'll see you on the 21st. We're going to move a replica propeller, so come be part of it. Thanks.
Thank you. Margaret O'Neill.
My name is Margaret O'Neill. Forgive me. I was coerced politely to come here. And I thought that there would be other people from my group, but apparently I'm the one speaking. So the prepared...
We're glad you're here.
Yeah, I'm sure they are too. So the prepared statement comes from Jim Murphy, and I'm part of an informal collaboration of the Tompkins County Veterans. I'm a U.S. veteran. We are the Finger Lakes Veterans Peace Coalition and Warrior Writers. We look out for the veterans that are living on the edge, often with emotional health issues such as PTSD, et cetera. The collaboration involves various individual professionals and veteran volunteers. Loaves and Fishes with J.R. Clearborn and Christina Culver and their volunteers often identify the veterans in need. Brad Bennett from the workforce is a wonderful asset. Major Ali Tammy Baker and the housing staff have also been incredible sources for vets. And we reach out to them ourselves. Our DA, Matt Van Houten, is connected to Kenna Murphy, Syracuse VA legal advocate for nonviolent cases involving veterans. All of our group of veterans are connected to Freeville and Syracuse. This is our primary goal for the veterans we all interact with, moving them into VA services. There are many reasons why some vets haven't been able to follow through. Young vets have PTSD and/or addictions. Old veterans that have led dysfunctional lives, such as alcohol, drugs, and homelessness, have emotional health issues also. For example, when someone in the collaboration identifies a needy veteran, this is James, if I am notified and it's an economic issue, the Finger Lakes Veterans Peace Coalition give out Wegmans and Green Star $25 and $50 food cards, and the relationship begins. Next, what are the needs? Do they need a phone? Do they need TCAT, food, laundry, etc.? The Peace Coalition will initially donate because we're very lucky that many Vietnam veterans in the area are economically able to provide the support. For jobs, the veterans will be sent to Bread Bannett at Workforce. Housing the veteran will start with TAMI or Finger Lakes Veterans Peace Coalition. A shout out to Carmen at Second Wind Cottages and INHS 210 Hancock or Ithaca Housing. Therapy for the veterans would then be with our writing group, the Warrior Writers, and for the Iraq, Afghanistan, and Somalia veterans, we have combat paper. So why do we need a county veterans office? Because we have a lot of vets that don't identify themselves and can't follow through. We need a center office and a counselor slash organizer that will be in place and available. We will continue to help. We do not want any more veterans suicides, veterans moving back into the woods, veterans living in hallways. If you can fund this, we will continue doing what we can because we care. I will point out that I was very blessed. I came to Ithaca. Sorry, that was unexpected. Because I was going to be homeless. And I got very lucky that my son said, Mom, you can come live with me. When I got here, again, pure luck, I went to the unemployment office, and Mr. Bennett, walking by, said, oh, are you a veteran? Nobody ever asked that because I don't look like your typical veteran. And I said, yes. When we started talking about unemployment and getting a job, he connected me with Jim. Jim then connected me with Warrior Writers, and the relationship began, and I got bamboozled to be here. But really, the reason I'm saying that is I've lived in a lot of places all over this country, and nobody ever bothered to ask. So nobody ever bothered to help along the way. And so I think a veterans office would be really important here. There's over 4,000 of these folks. And, you know, there's like 20 of us in the little group. We can't take care of 4,000. We really need a little help. Thank you.
Thank you. Lisa Avron.
Hello. My name is Lisa Avron. I live on North Aurora Street. I just want to say thank you for everyone being here and listening, and hello to the folks from who are holding place for our history here in Ithaca and people representing our veterans. So I'm here on behalf of the Office of Human Rights, Tompkins County's Office of Human Rights, and I think we all pretty much know what's going on with that. So I'm going to start by saying that Xavier Rusk, who is a paralegal aide for the Office of Human Rights, is an incredible person. He's an expert in his field. He's brilliant. He's really brilliant. He has an untarnished reputation, and he has a drive to do good, real good. And I don't think anybody here would say otherwise, right? In fact, I think all of you probably agree with me, to be honest with you. Now, in choosing to structure our budget in the manner that you are choosing to structure it, in a way that weakens OHR, that takes away the paralegal aid office, that turns it into essentially a kiosk, you are saying one of three things. One, you do not believe Xavier Rusk and his claim that 400-plus community members per year who report acts of discrimination, socioeconomic discrimination, racial discrimination, gender discrimination, and his claim that the state cannot handle this many cases, that it does not handle these cases, and that he has, because he has the experience, he's done it, he knows. So you're saying you do not believe him. Number two, and this I don't even want to imply because I don't think it's true, but it is a logical conclusion. You do not believe the people who were reporting these crimes, which I don't think is true, because I don't think any of you would say that you do not believe the 400-plus community members who are approaching the OHR and looking for solutions to their discrimination, right? Or three, and I don't want to imply this at all either, but this is, again, another logical conclusion. You both believe Xavier Rusk and his claims that the state cannot handle these cases, and you believe the 400-plus community members who are coming per year to him and to the OHR with these claims, but that you don't want to pay to help these people. You don't want to find the place in the budget to help these people in the way that these experts are saying that they need to be helped. Now, the reason why I'm laying it out this way is because I want to point to the fact that this is, while this presentation is incredible and beyond my comprehension, I'm a PhD student at Cornell. Like, I'm not a, you know, I'm not a slacker. It's hard to keep up with. But this is not about numbers. This isn't about a budget. This is about a moral and ethical commitment. And I think that's a really, really important way of framing this issue, because I don't think that this is about a budget. I think this is about a moral and ethical commitment. Thank you.
Thank you. Ruth Yarrow.
Good evening. Thank you for listening. I come as a volunteer for OAR, driving people to the jail, as a member of Surge, showing up for racial justice. And I've been really concerned about what's happening with our Office for Human Rights also. I appreciate the attention that you're put on thinking about the budget and probably the move from where it is now to where it's proposed may be a good one in terms of fiscally, and it's also still accessible. I hope that all county agencies are scrutinized the way the Office for Human Rights has been. I heard a comment from a former member of the legislature saying it's often too easy for the legislature to look hard at entities where the people who are affected are unlikely to speak up. And, you know, for instance, the airport, if people who use the airport are upset with what your decision, you're going to hear from them. If the people who are struggling with problems with their housing and their employment are unlikely to come and speak to you. So some of the rest of us are trying to do that. And I hope you, that's an important thing. I hope that sticks in your mind. One thing that was not clear to me on Monday was why the paralegal aid position was being removed. I tried to figure that out. It was presented as a fait accompli. I didn't hear the rationale for it. All that I have seen is that Xavier Rusk is well-trained, that he's appreciated in what he does, and that the clientele really want a knowledgeable local person to bring their problems to. It can't be budgetary reasons, because I know that you fund the office well, and with his removal, you even have more funding in that particular budget. I think it's hard to say that it's just because the state has said they won't continue the memorandum of understanding, because the work continued here even when we didn't have that. I don't think we can say it's because there's less need. I mean, when we look at our county administrator's graphs, you can see things like the level of unemployment has gone down, but that doesn't cover a lot of things. It doesn't cover people who have given up. It doesn't cover people who are partly employed. When I drive people to the jail, they say, you know, I have a few hours a week, but I can't get more hours. I don't have enough money. There are a lot of hidden things. When we look at these graphs, it may look pretty good, but from the point of view of people who are suffering, who are lowest in our economic strata, it does not look good. And that's our job, is to look for those people and to see their needs in particular. And I think, yes, that leaves money for outreach and education. But in my view, the Office of Human Rights really needs a strong advocacy piece, or it's not doing its job. It just, I don't know if it's a good analogy, but with the civil rights movement, if you just had education and outreach, things wouldn't have changed. But when you had laws, or you had some teeth, some strength, some power, then things begin to change and help those who need it most. So what I'm really looking for here is a human rights commission, an office for human rights that has a big vision, that wants to make Tompkins County really stand out in that it cares for the kind of people that we've just been hearing from, and that we consider everything that might really help, such as a local comprehensive human rights law. We really need to look, open up, and think about the whole picture and come back to where, as many of my friends have said who've been on the commission in the past or been in the office, and some of you here have, it used to be a vibrant and very effective organization, and it can be again. And it's going to take some deep thinking and real commitment. Thank you.
Thank you. Laura Branca.
Good evening. You're going to hear a little theme here from the three of us who've just spoken. I would like to express my interest and advocacy in passing the OHR budget. I'm happy that it's not being cut. I'm encouraged that you'll be saving on the rent by moving to the County Office of the Aging. I think it's too bad that the current location will be lost, because I think a lot of people find that very accessible and welcoming. But if it doesn't meet ADA requirements, that's okay. Move it to some place where it will. Save some money on the rent. So there's even more money for services and outreach. What I don't like about the budget proposal, unless it's been changed recently, and I have to admit I haven't read it this week, is the elimination of the paralegal position. I think Lisa said, I know Xavier Rusk, and so in terms of the person who's occupying that position, he is really quite fabulous. And he also has standing in the community. He has a lot of support because he does serve the people in a really passionate way. But aside from his merits as a person, who I very much want to see in that job, the position of paralegal is really important, and I would even say that we need two paralegals, or a paralegal and a half. I looked on the OHR website at 6 o'clock tonight to make sure it hadn't been changed, and it said it was created in 1963 as Tompkins County's Civil Rights Enforcement and Human Rights Outreach Agency, and that the mission is to work towards the elimination and prevention of unlawful discrimination, among other things. And that civil rights enforcement means that we work to eliminate and prevent unlawful discrimination in many, many aspects, employment, housing, credit, places of public accommodation, but also based on age, creed, race, color, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, national origin, marital status, disability, military status, arrest record, conviction record, predisposing genetic characteristics, and familial status. And gives as an example, OHR is charged with enforcing local law number 1-2004, chapter 92, anti-discrimination, which we're, as a community, very, very proud of. This is a feather in Tompkins County's cap that we took the initiative to do this years ago, and that it was accomplished through a public, through a community and legislative government coalition to actually enact that, to draft that legislation and enact it. So, we're not going away about wanting comprehensive local anti-discrimination law. We don't get a lot of support for that idea, but we're not going away. And so if you think about why would you, in anticipation of getting that law expanded, you could expand local law to embrace all protected classes. That wouldn't be a terribly expensive prospect to just draft the local law and expand it to include all of us. But in addition to that, if you got that, that would give you the foundation to actually do what your website says the office does, which is enforce anti-discrimination law. If you do that, then you want to have in place a capacity within the office to actually carry out that enforcement. Someone who has the expertise about human rights law to actually be able to help people navigate that process when they have complaints and to perhaps conciliate, to talk locally with people who are accused of discrimination so that we can work things out on a local level. I believe in that mission. I think it's a really important thing that we've got the Office of Human Rights, and I think it makes us a special place in New York State. But if we don't have the capacity to actually fulfill it, then it's very weak. The other thing I just want to say is that back in March and again in May, Reverend Clark and then later Mr. Molino reported to the legislature that you were going to engage in a community assessment and analysis, which meant that you were going to reach out to a number of organizations, and three of them I'm a member of. And it wasn't until August that we were actually invited to meet for that community assessment conversation. In middle August, everyone was on vacation, people were going out of town, people were not available to do it, and Action, for instance, wrote an extensive memo, which I think you all got copies of, and we laid out the things that we answered the questions that would have been in the in-person interview. Then we again met with Reverend Clark, and by remote, we met with Jason Molino to reinforce the things that we wanted. But one of our members said it seemed really disingenuous to be engaging so seriously in this community assessment process when the budget proposal had already been submitted, eliminating one of the most important positions to us without the feedback of the stakeholders that you were intending to contact. So if you're serious about it, we've given a lot of information, and I hope that influences the decision, because if you eliminate the people with the legal expertise and the knowledge of human rights law, and then you would have a perfect excuse not to bother with enacting a comprehensive law. You'd say, well, we don't have anybody who can actually deal with it. So I hope that you will be encouraged that we're not going away, that we want to see this happen, and that in anticipation of that, you keep Xavier, you keep Xavier's position. Xavier's also an outstanding educator around human rights, and that is something that the office is supposed to be structured to continue to do for the public. So I think that's it. And whether you expand the law to include Ban the Box and Source of Income or that separately, I think there's some momentum for Source of Income and Ban the Box enactment. So that's great, but that's not enough. We need to have all protected classes covered in our local law. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all I have signed up tonight. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to us tonight? Sure, step to the microphone. Former city councilman J.R. Claiborne.
Good evening, everybody. I just came to add my two cents on the veterans position. You've heard a lot through Margaret of Jim's statement. I'm the JR that was mentioned in her statement, which I didn't know was going to happen, so thank you. But I just want to say that one of the things that's really interesting about the veterans, it's really more of a net than it is a blanket. Like Jason mentioned about the safety blanket in his presentation, what we have here is really a broken net. And I say broken in respects that a veteran who comes to town has to know who to check in with or where to find whatever representative or just happenstance. Like you said, you were just asked by Brad. And that's what we have. We have folks who come to Loaves and Fishes, if they recognize themselves as a veteran, I immediately call Jim or I refer them to Brad or I try to find some way we'll call in Ben from the Veterans Administration. The point is that there's not a point person or point place. If there are, they're doing the same things that we're doing. We're trying to figure out how to get people introduced. I thought it was interesting that Cornell established a veterans representative last year because they saw a need with the students that they have, their student body of veterans coming back. Around town, particularly with the newer veterans, the ones that have just been getting out, I'd say within the last 10 years or so, they're not coming out wearing any kind of champion that says the T-shirt, hat, says I'm a veteran. They're a very silent group. They're more silent than veterans in general. I would say veterans locally are pretty much, we are a silent group, but we're a big group. A lot of us, you have us in your families, or the families themselves have someone that they know who is in the who is a veteran who served in armed forces. And it's really interesting that there's not really a point place. And one thing I think that's most striking about that for me is that if you've dealt with any veterans issues or if you've known people who do, a lot of times the family people or the family members are who becomes that veterans advocate. Because for various reasons, whether it's pride, whether there is something, a lot of people are dealing with PTSD, a lot of other issues that go along with that. And so they're not able or not willing to just come out forward and say, I have a problem. But their family members are the ones who are dealing with that at home, and they're the ones who will come out and look for someone to say, can you help us, or how do we get connected, where is our health, where do we connect for health care, or whatever else it is. So it would be very good if we had something here locally that there is an office, not just a person, so I'm projecting forward here, that there is an office that can actually pull all of these things together but can also serve as a representative place for our veterans. I would say just in closing that last night, I met this group of people, Seven Winds Volunteers. And I believe the group, they're part of the Travis Manion Foundation. I'm probably saying that wrong, but they are here helping out at Second Wind Cottages. They're helping do a build and finish off the last cottages out there. These are folks who are coming from all over the country, and they're all members of, let me say this differently, they're all survivors. They call themselves survivors of fallen members of our armed forces. So these are people who have decided that they wanted to make something out of their lost ones' dedication to our country, and they're helping other people around the country. And wouldn't it be something great that we have somewhere here in Tompkins County, or I'll back up, wouldn't it have been good when they were here last night to take them to an office and say, in Tompkins County, we have an office here, and when you come back, please check in here. All of our veterans are spread out around the county. A lot of our connections are made by word of mouth,
I think we've talked about some of it now, but there's a lot of unofficial. You go to, especially like Home Depot or Lowe's, that's where I've run into some people, and other folks who just happen to bring it up. But it would be very good, I think, to have something that recognizes the dedication of our veterans, and particularly of their families, because they are folks who not only have given, but they continue to give to our community.
Thank you. Is there anyone else? Not seeing any other hands. We're going Martha Robertson, of course.
If you were interested in a little discussion or answering questions or anything.
Well, we haven't normally done that, but if it's up to the legislature if they'd like to do something like that. Folks want to stay and talk? How many people want to stay and respond in some way?
So I think we have. All right. Well, I just thought there are a couple questions in particular about OHR, and I wanted to make sure people know that the Health and Human Services Committee is going to be talking about this next Tuesday. The it's a $186 million budget, right? And 27 departments. I don't know what the count of agencies is. So when we do have these budget discussions, we don't get into the depth on particular departments. That happens in program committees, like the succession planning in Department of Emergency Response is talked about in the Public Safety Committee, et cetera. So, Jason, I wonder if you could just give people a little preview of next week's conversation about OHR.
Sure. So, this assessment includes multiple things. We have had, Dr. Clark's had the majority of the conversations with a lot of community members. I've been a part of a few conversations. It involves a little history of the office, kind of going back to when it was conceived and how it's maybe changed over a period of time, just to give a basis understanding of it. We address or try to address a lot of the issues or questions brought up, whether, for example, what the office can be doing, what it could be doing, what do those options mean, meaning can we enforce claims? Can we file claimants through the process? Can we adopt a comprehensive local law? And we kind of try to break out what some of those options mean, how, if they could be implemented, how would they be implemented, and what it means or what it doesn't mean with respect to impact on the office. So we talk a little bit about that. We did get some data from the Division of Human Rights of the state in terms of the numbers of claims. We don't get into the detail of the claims because we don't have access to that information, but we'll go over some of the history from 1999 to 2017. Claims, how they, what some of the outcomes were those, meaning, were they no probable cause determinations, no probable cause determinations, and how that may have trended over a period of time, because there's been some speculation and discussion openly about what has happened with the number of claims and where those claims are coming from. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well, and then we'll give some proposals or suggestions to the legislature as how we move forward, anywhere from filling the or advertising and then doing the interview process for the Director of Human Rights for a permanent appointment into that, and then some of the processes as the state has requested that we follow as we go through the claimant process. We'll also talk a little bit about conciliation and mediation and how that can play a bigger role moving forward. Just had a conversation yesterday, I believe, Shauna, with the Center for Dispute Resolution, Dr. Clark, as well as Jonathan Wood, the county attorney, were there. We'll add some insight as to that discussion as well and how we can see that relationship strengthen in the future. Education and outreach is also a piece. And then also, how do we aid claimants in facilitating, ensuring that they get the due process they deserve through the enforcement process that's outlined in the state law. So we'll... Oh, I'm sorry. So we'll talk about all of that in this review, in this report. It's conclusive to the extent that what we worked on over the past few months. It doesn't mean that there isn't more work to be done, but we'll address a lot of those questions and a lot of those can we do this or why can't we do that discussion pieces. That came from a lot of the discussions with community members.
Okay, appreciate that. Thanks very much.
Yep. I was going to call on Leslin, but she stepped out for a minute. Are there others that would like to speak tonight on our group?
And just that meeting is Tuesday at 3 o'clock. Is that right, Shauna?
I believe so. It's early.
That's correct. Tuesday at 3 o'clock.
Thanks.
Let's wait just a second for Leslin. I just got over that cold that she's suffering with, so I know how it is. Anna?
Just while we're sitting here waiting awkwardly, I figured I just, for myself, I'm here to hear people. I mean, that's what we've been meeting for weeks and weeks on this, discussing this. So this was our opportunity to listen instead of talk. And I think that I suspect that a lot of my colleagues feel the same way. We're here for listening. So the next 2 weeks, we'll be doing a lot of talking in response to some of the things that we are hearing, community conversations that I know several of my colleagues and I are having with many of you. So please feel free to come to those meetings as well, because those will be follow-ups to this.
You wanted to ask Lisa a specific question?
Hmm?
Did you want to ask her a specific question?
No, I thought she made, when you spoke and she said that others might want to speak, so I thought maybe she wanted to speak.
Do you want me to go ask her?
Sure. Yeah. Ann Corman.
I wanted to thank everybody that came tonight, whether it was to listen or to, you know, especially to speak. And I wanted to address one of the issues as far as the office, the OHR office, is that we are here to not just listen to you. We are not here just to make decisions, but we are here to engage with the public. So some people mentioned, you know, that you can come to certain meetings. You can talk to your own legislator. You can talk to people on different committees. So please engage us. You know, I know a lot of times people come in and they've heard something, you know, which might be part of the story. So please come in. You know, we're more than willing to sit down with folks and help fill you in a little bit more, so you have, you know, at least other parts of the story.
Yes, I want to thank everyone for sharing their evening with us and their comments. We appreciate that, and we'll keep them in mind as we move forward into the remainder of the budget process. Leslin, I guess, did you want to say anything? All right. We just wanted to give you the opportunity. All right, then I'm going to adjourn our meeting today and thank everyone again.